Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Heretics Hour with me, Carolyn Yeager. The date is March 30th, 2015, and this is a live show tonight, so callers are welcome. The call-in number is 323-642-1206. Maybe I should say. And I'm not really aiming for a two-hour program tonight either, but I'll just let it take its own course, so we'll see. Before I get started, I want to thank Raymond S., not Raymond Goodwin, for a generous donation this past week and for a nice card and letter that accompanied it. I'm going to read it to you. Raymond wrote on March 18, 2015, "Hello, Carolyn. 5 years of hard work. Your five-year anniversary program was excellent. I have listened to your program since you were broadcasting on Voice of Reason. I found that your read-along programs, such as The International Jew and Hitler's Table Talk, have allowed me to set aside time each week when I could read along with you and your guests. I do not think that I would have found the time to read those works otherwise on my own. Your reading from portions of The Fire broadened my knowledge of the massive U.S. and British bombing campaigns of genocidal destruction that was visited on the innocent German civilians throughout the country, certainly war crimes without punishment. You deserve to be recognized for your indefatigable research, intelligence, courage, and perseverance in educating the uneducated and even the uneducable. You are so recognized by me. I have enclosed a little something to help defray some of your current expenses. I look forward to your next 5 years of programs." Well, good luck with that. "Best personal wishes to you, and enjoy the cup of tea. Raymond from Florida." Well, Raymond did send a packet of tea that was a part of the card that he sent, and I really do appreciate hearing from listeners like that. And, of course, I like it especially when they're so nice and complimentary, as Raymond was, but I do like hearing from you in this way. Well, I've decided to talk about the plane crash today because there are a lot of side issues that it brings up, and it also has been a focus that I have a hard time taking my mind away from. I'm always interested in what the next information that comes up about it might be. But before I get into that, I want to tell you about one little story that was in the local dot Austria about a 71-year-old doctor who was sentenced for Holocaust denial. And he's from Upper Austria. He's been sentenced to 1 year's house arrest for Holocaust denial. On Thursday, a jury at Linz Court unanimously agreed that the letter the doctor had sent to the local council and the administration of the Mauthausen concentration camp memorial site in Upper Austria proved that he believed that the gas chambers and the systematic genocidal killing had been made up. Now, notice that they say that he believes this, but then he also wrote that letter. But they also seem to think there that if you believe it, you're a problem, that you might be guilty of something. And I want to tell you that Mauthausen concentration camp was a grade 3 camp, which meant that it was intended to be that one of the toughest camps for the incorrigible political enemies of the Reich. I don't know who made that statement, the incorrigible political enemies of the Reich, but there were grades of camps. And grade 1 was the nicest one, the best one. And then there was 2, and I think Buchenwald was a grade 2. And this camp was a grade 3, so it really was meant to be more harsh and less pleasantries than the other camps. So this was the type of camp it was, but it didn't have a gas chamber. There's nobody's hardly ever insisted that it had a gas chamber, but this man wrote that he noticed this doctor that he noticed that there was no gas pipe leading to the gas chamber that they have, that they call a gas chamber there, and he could find no explanation of why this was so. The head of the memorial appeared in court, and he said that SS men had removed the gas pipes shortly before the camp was liberated in 1945. And he says this was proven because the area where the pipes would have been had been plastered over. Well, that's all he had to say, obviously, that where he says the pipes would have been has been plastered over. Who knows who plastered over it, you know, but he says that the SS did it. Now, I say there were no gas chambers at Mauthausen, and this man who was from the Mühlviertel region in Upper Austria wrote that he became convinced after visiting the Mauthausen site that the gas chambers had never existed and that therefore the Holocaust must be a lie made up by Zionist bankers who are still up to their mischief in Israel and the Arab Spring. That's all in a quote there. And I think it's kind of funny, cute, if you can call something like this with a word like that, that he doesn't want to say Jews. You know, that's in Austria, that's really, really get in trouble. So he calls them Zionist bankers. That's what he called them, who made up the Holocaust. And then he goes on to claim that Hitler and Germany were not to blame for World War II and that Austria would be forever burdened with the Holocaust cudgel. Well, you know, he is right, and good for him for saying that and for standing up for that. And for doing so, he gets a little attention, but he has to accept a one-year house arrest for it all. Okay. I want to tell you a little more about Mauthausen because and their so-called gas chamber, which they didn't have. What, you know, on Wikipedia has a very long page on this camp and goes through, it covers all kinds of terrible things that went on there. Starvation and, people trying to kill people from overwork. They did have a rather harsh work schedule. Well, I don't know how harsh it was. They worked in quarries, mining. You know, anybody who went to the Soviet Union gulags, they were doing a lot of that. Even Wilhelm Christman was doing mining, quarrying in when he was in that British-run camp in Austria for almost 2 years. Now, but from 1940, Mauthausen was one of the few camps in the West to use a gas chamber on a regular basis. This is what Wikipedia says in one little tiny paragraph. They cover the whole gas chamber thing in this one little paragraph where somebody has added that they had a gas chamber earlier than the other camps, starting in 1940. In the beginning, an improvised mobile gas chamber, a van with the exhaust pipe connected to the inside, shuttles between Mauthausen and Gusen. They didn't have a gas chamber, they had a gas van. We've read all about those, or we've heard about them at least, and those were fake too. However, and Gusen was a sub-camp of Mauthausen that was supposedly worse than what was going on at Mauthausen. By December 1941, it reads, a permanent gas chamber that could kill about 120 prisoners at a time was completed. And there's two sources for this. Neither one of them are good. One is Robert Abzug, who wrote in 1987, Inside the Vicious Heart. So you can imagine what kind of a book that was. And the second one was by Michael Shermer and Alex Grobman. Together they, I think it might have been even an article called The Gas Chamber at Mauthausen. It was written in 2002. Great sources, huh? We know that Michael Shermer is a proven liar, and even David Cole has called him a liar. So there you go with that. Now to move on to the crash. I call it the crash, and why I say that it reveals anti-Germanism that continues not only from 1945, but actually anti-Germanism started coming along in 1871, if there wasn't some of it earlier, but I mean, I'm not going back to anything so far in the past, which would have been temporary maybe. But this crash was so horrific, this German wings crash in the French Alps, that it threw an engine turbine 400 meters up from the point of impact. That's pretty amazing. And the debris of the plane is spread across some 2 hectares, or 5 acres, of mountainside. 5 acres it's spread. But they say they're not giving up until they find this flight data recorder, which logs not giving up the search around there. They've been finding body parts and other things, but they're still looking for that flight data recorder, which logs all the technical data from the flight, or machine data, and it's essential for the investigation, some people say. Even the investigators say they really want to find that so that their investigation can be complete. They feel that it's complete and certain, that both of those should be able to be looked at. But if it has, one of the investigators said, if it has not been completely destroyed or pulverized, the black box will be under the rubble and debris. We must work with caution and a lot of precision. Well, they found the casing of the flight data recorder, but it had been broken open. It was damaged so badly, and the contents were not in there. So the contents had been knocked out. I don't know if that's a black box or if it's just called a black box, but the casing is kind of a bright orange. And these black boxes are supposed to send out a signal so that they can be found. But this one is not sending out any signal, so it's obviously pretty badly damaged. But they're hoping that if they just keep going through all the rubble, that they'll come across it. And that would be very good if they did. Well, now, why I am talking about anti-Germanism rising here is that there's a few examples of it. It's not surprising the way it's put and who it's directed to, but still, if this was a crash by any other country, you wouldn't see things like this. You wouldn't hear things like this being said. So I'm going to go through them. There's not that many, but the only ones that I know about. And on his first one is Neil Cavuto. On his daily TV show on Fox News Friday, he talked about the recent tragedy when a German pilot deliberately crashed a plane, killing 150 innocent people. Forever, I say that, you know, I'm not sure that this pilot is, well, I'm going to skip that. This quote is from Cavuto's stupid speech on his TV show. He said, something turns them, he's talking about mass murderers or killers, and he says, something turns them, changes them, perverts them. But what? When? Why? None of these questions are new that we've asked, and we've asked them time and time again before. How about, about how these otherwise ordinary-looking men going through airport security would later fly the planes they boarded into buildings, and then it shows on the screen, on the television screen, the 9/11 hijackers in the airport, etc. You know, before they supposedly boarded these planes, and then he says, and how this slightly odd fellow, who apparently loved dogs, could happily butcher millions of human beings. And he shows a picture of, guess who, Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun with their dogs on leashes. It's a very well-known photograph. So he had to bring up Hitler into the bargain here. That's Cavuto. he's saying that this German pilot and Hitler loved to carry out mass murder. Now, also there was something at the Huffington Post, not surprising to find it there, and I just happened to see the headline somewhere, and so I went, and there it was at Huffington Post. But they had an article featuring a number of the crash victims, and they featured all the non-Germans on the plane, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them, and then a few Spanish and a few Germans, two really, and then the class. So they're, I just took it that they don't want to see Germans as victims too much. You know, they don't want to portray Germans as victims, so they play down the Germans that died on that plane. And the number was about 72 now is what they say, 72 Germans and 30 Spanish people, and the rest were assorted from assorted places. That I don't know how many assorted places, but they had on that article two or three from Kazakhstan. No, they had one or maybe two or three from each of these countries that I'm going to name. That's all that was on that plane, whereas there was over 70 Germans, you see. But they showed pictures and wrote articles and everything about these people. One was from Kazakhstan, and another from Colombia, Argentina, Japan, United States, Australia, Britain, Iran, and Israel. And there was only one Israeli on that plane, but they played him up real good and had comments from his family about what a wonderful guy he was and so on. And pictures of these people. Maybe they're the only ones they could find pictures of. I don't know. But they feature on there a few more Spaniards than they do Germans. And the Germans that they mentioned were two opera singers, the two opera singers which have been talked about mostly. And one of these opera singers is actually a Ukrainian who moved to Germany for his career. And then they mentioned the 16 high school students, but don't name them. However, I think they don't want to be named as yet. That's possible. That could be why they didn't name them. And their two teachers. So they don't encourage, as I said, seeing Germans as victims. And these non-Germans, I don't mean to put them down by that, but they will be seen as victims of the German pilot and the failed policies of the German airliner Lufthansa. And then there's going to be a memorial at Cologne Cathedral in two or three weeks in Germany. But I'll bet that it will have a very strong international flavor to it, and it will not be, the German victims will not be given any kind of a primary focus there either. So that's typical of the way the modern Germany treats German victims. But there's also something in the New York Times which was quite unpalatable, unattractive. And a friend sent this to me just today. I had not seen it. I think it was from the 28th, but I'm glad that I saw it this afternoon. And several things that they say in there. The first one I'm going to quote is, they write, in the decades since it emerged from the ruins of Nazism, this country, which reunited in 1990 and in recent years has dominated Europe as its economic powerhouse, has come to define itself as orderly, rule-driven, and well-engineered. It is an identity that is both an antidote to its past and a blueprint for economic success. So that's not very friendly, you know. It talks about that it has to bring up the ruins of Nazism. Well, as a matter of fact, it was the ruins that the Allies created. Germany was a fine country if it hadn't been bombed the way it was. So that it wasn't the Nazis who created those ruins, but they want to say if it wasn't for the Nazis, it never would have happened. So, and you know, I do want to point out right now that the New York Times is probably the most Jewy of all the Jew-run newspapers. But it has a more sophisticated slant to it, and for that reason, it gets to be even nastier than any normal Jewish-run paper would think about being. So the next quote from this New York Times article is, "Now, Mr. Lubitz, born and raised in one of those pretty towns," Bobby talked about the orderly, well-driven country that it was, and then he talks about a country of pretty little towns, and he says, "Mr. Lubitz, born and raised in one of those pretty towns, has upended that well-ordered world and challenged other assumptions built into German life." So the assumptions about how well-ordered and how safe and good German life is have been upended by this Lubitz, according to the New York Times. And they are just dripping dislike and put down when they talk about how this horrible man was raised in one of those pretty little towns. And they would not speak of pretty Swiss towns like this, I'll bet anything. Now, then further on they say, "Germans' determination to guard their privacy is a legacy of Nazi and communist rule, where when the state snooped on citizens," they're blaming what happened on too much emphasis, too much need for privacy in German life, that they act like the Germans want all that privacy and demand it. But I have a different take on that, which I'll come up to in a little while, maybe very shortly. But it's a lie that the privacy that the public was snooped on, that the Nazi regime, and they say communist rule. Well, in East Germany, the communist rule, but we're talking about, communist rule in East Germany. But it's a lie that the Nazis snooped on citizens. They didn't. The snooping on citizens comes after 1945 in order to counteract what the National Socialist regime was like. So it goes on to say, "As often happens in Germany, teenagers cited their right not to talk to the media or gave only their first names." Well, they're putting down the people, even the teenagers, they said, from this school where 16 of their classmates died in this plane crash, that they don't want to talk to the media and they only want to give first names. Well, you know, as though it's because they don't trust anyone, they're very suspicious and overdo the need for privacy and so on. Well, the fact is they don't trust the media or the rest of the world. Germans don't. They intrinsically know what people think of them and what the media might say. And so they don't really trust, they don't have a lot of trust in those functions, but that doesn't mean they don't trust one another. And then the last one here is about the Lufthansa. And Mr. Spohr, he's the spokesman, the president, is he now the president of Lufthansa? He's been speaking a lot. He's been the one who's been in the news quite a bit, making comments and statements. And they say, when Mr. Spohr was asked to explain the gap of many months in Mr. Lubitz's training, he cited the confidentiality of medical records, although the co-pilot was dead. Not even the head of Lufthansa has access, he said. So this was an interesting insight here, that they're trying to get Lufthansa on being at fault to some degree here, but he said that there was a law about confidentiality of medical records, and they didn't have access to his medical records. Well, they didn't have access to his medical records, but the doctors could have done something about that, and we'll get to that. I want to just look at the Lubitz name, the meaning. There's been a lot of conversation on certain sites about this man being Jewish, which a lot of people would jump to that right away, that he's a Jew. Lubitz is a Jewish name. Well, I never thought that he was a Jew, although he could be, but, I mean, the family could be. I think it's, I thought right away that he was Polish, and I think that in his pictures he looks Polish to me. But if I was told he was German and went all, you know, with the German all the way back, whatever, I could then say, well, okay, you know, he looks German too. So he can't really go by that. But I did try to find out what I could and on this, and I found that the name on one site said it was an Eastern German name, a habitational name for a place, from a place so named or from any of several places, similarly named, all of Slavic origin. I do think it's originally a Slavic name. And then I found there that the ITZ endings come from East Germany only. They're only in East Germany, not in West Germany, because of Prussian-Polish mixture there. And it's a, therefore, it's a Germanized Polish spelling, actually. Lubitz is Polish, with a, but the spelling is Germanized. So, and also that Lubitz meaning was a descendant of Lubomir. Now, to look into the Jewish aspect of it, I didn't find very much, you know. Looking at these Jewish ancestry sites for people with that name, in the only thing I actually found was that in the largest Jewish cemetery in Buenos Aires, there are 7 Lubitz names who were immigrants to Buenos Aires in 1908 to 1927. Well, they've got these, okay, this is 2 different things. In the largest Jewish cemetery in this big city, Buenos Aires, there's only 7 names of Lubitz. That's not very much, see, not much at all. And then there are there's some immigration records to Buenos Aires from 1908 to 1927, 10 with the name of Lubitz. And 5 of these were Catholic, 4 Protestant, and 1 unknown religion. Well, they could be just listing themselves as Catholic and Protestant and be, and you know, to hide their Jewishness. I don't know, do I, whether they're Catholic, Protestant, or not. So, but 8 of them came from ships leaving Bremen or Hamburg, and 2 came from a ship leaving Marseille. And they might even be just 3 families all with, you know, all with having that name of Lubitz. Okay, so the next thing up is a story by in the Telegraph UK about Lubitz's father. And this was on the 28th of March, and it says that his father is devastated, completely shattered by his son's act. Well, and this is according to a French official who spoke to him, and this French official is the mayor of Prades-Haute-Bléon, a small town near the site of the crash. So we have to depend on him. But he seems to be, he's very, very sympathetic to Mr. Lubitz. He says he is carrying on his back the entire weight of the drama. He is a man whose life has broken down. Mr. Bartolini, the French mayor, says he met them when they visited the crash site and attended a memorial ceremony nearby on Thursday. He, the father, is a man whose life is in ruins. He goes on and on like that. I mean, who cares about his life? You know, who has sympathy for him? I want to know more about him and where he comes from and what he does for a living. Well, this guy goes on to say how much respect he has for him and so on. I wonder why he's going on and on. He said even more than this. about it. But to find out about the parents, there was some information about the early years, saying that the young Lubitz grew up in the small town of Montebauer in the Rhineland, a town of 15,000, just a nice little size, 20 minutes drive from the German city of Koblenz. With his father was a successful business executive and his mother a piano teacher. The family was very comfortable and could well afford the cost of flying lessons at the local clubs for their, what seems to be, only child. There's no mention anywhere of siblings, or which I'm sure that would have come up somewhere along the line by now. So he must be an only child. And here he's, he left Montebar at the age of 20. So up until then, he was living with his parents full time in this town. That was in 2007, to begin his commercial pilot's training in the northern German city of Bremen. It was a year into his training that he appears to have suffered the breakdown and took a break before returning to qualify. So at the age of 21 in 2008, he's already had this breakdown. Obviously, the stress of the training was too much for him. He wanted to be a pilot from an early age, they say, and he was very proficient at it. He did it, you know, he was capable at it, and yet he couldn't deal with the training for some reason or whatever else might have been going on. And a mother of a schoolmate of his told the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung that he had told her daughter, Lubitz had told her daughter, that he had taken a break from his pilot training because he was suffering from depression. I wonder how long he had been suffering from depression. The woman said, that this mother said, apparently he had a burnout, he was in depression. She said her daughter had seen him again just before Christmas and that he had appeared normal. She added he was a lovely boy. Well, you know how they talk like that. He had a good family background. They lived in a nice house and so on. And he was a very polite, they say, a very well-behaved young man. So he had a good reputation with everybody in the town. There's another person... This Mr. Radker, the flying club president, said he last saw Lubitz in the autumn of last year, 2014, autumn, when he returned to the club to renew his light aircraft flying license and take part in the club's barbecue, which he attended with a girlfriend. That's all we know there. Maybe that was the flight attendant girlfriend from 2014. He said nobody at the club noticed anything strange in his demeanor. And this Rucker, another friend of his from the air club at home, his hometown air club, Peter Reuker, said he did not believe that Lubitz was capable of such a thing because flying was his dream. So you see how these people can be fooled. It's not hard if you have learned how to do it to behave properly, because you know any other behavior is not going to be accepted, is not appropriate. So you learn how to behave and cover up your stress, your poor stress management, which is what he seemed to have. And this Reuker is saying he doesn't believe he's capable of doing what they say he's done. But here's the thing with the father. The parents, they must have noticed something. But they, you know how parents are. They hope for the best. And they think that he'll straighten out. They must have seen signs. And no wonder the man is so upset now if he's feeling, he should be feeling guilty about not saying anything. But the latest here about Lubitz and everything they know about him came out today. And this one says that that in the cockpit recorder transcript that has leaked out, the final minutes of the plane can be revealed that the frantic captain is heard screaming at co-pilot Lubitz to open the damn door. Now, the captain's name was Patrick Sondheimer. That's definitely a German name. He pleaded with Lubitz to unlock the cockpit door before taking an axe in a desperate attempt to stop the plane crashing. This was published by the Bild Sonntag yesterday, but I don't know. There's some people saying they don't know for sure that he used an axe. I don't know where they got that idea, but they did. And then the thing about his eyesight, that came up real big. All of a sudden he feared going blind. He was going for treatment for his eyesight and so on. Well, the facts about that can be determined are that he did go to a hospital to have his eyes checked, but here it says investigators will be examining the theory that severe stress caused by a fear he might lose his job as a consequence of failing eyesight may have driven him to commit suicide by flying an Airbus into the side of a mountain into the French Alps. Okay. Well, you know, what you notice when you keep reading all these news articles for a week or two, that the newspapers, of course, are going to grab hold of any new piece of information that they can find. They're going to play it up so that they have a story that's, you know, new information, and people will buy their newspaper, read it online or whatever, and that gives them more advertising revenue. So that's the way these newspapers work, and you really can't be sure, excuse me, what they're, how well they have investigated this. They probably haven't. They've just heard it, and they think it's a pretty good source, so they use it. So that's why the thing about the eyesight is kind of confused. And the New York Times reported over the weekend, it says, that old New York Times again, that Lubitz had sought treatment at Dusseldorf University Hospital for his eyesight. And the hospital confirmed that Lubitz had attended the hospital in February for an evaluation and then returned on March 10th for further treatment. The hospital has refused to say why Lubitz had sought treatment, but significantly ruled out claims it was for depression. And that would and so that would lend weight to the claims that Lubitz had gone to the eye clinic, which is situated inside the hospital. The authorities had not ruled out the possibility, somebody said, somebody close to the, with knowledge of the investigation, said the authorities had not ruled out the possibility that the vision problem could have been psychosomatic. So he could be so worried and because there's no evidence that he was given a positive diagnosis of anything being wrong with his eyes. It says, repeating about how he had this sick note excusing him from work, but he didn't present it. He didn't use these sick notes. He tore them up and threw them away. And another little item that came up was that police said, the police who investigated the premises were said to have found a small mountain of antidepressants, which it did not appear Lubitz had been taking. So he may have been getting along all those years, like from the time he was 21 in 2008, and he had his breakdown. He may have been getting along by taking antidepressants. But they're saying that a lot of them there, it didn't appear that he had been taking them. Well, whatever that's worth. He was said by friends to have been feeling low after recently splitting with his girlfriend, with whom he lived. This is kind of difficult because the convincing girlfriend that came and talked to the police, who they call Maria W., so she says they broke up in 2014. She broke up with him. So he wasn't just, he didn't just break up with a girlfriend. And yet there seems to be another girlfriend, possibly, a new one, who he broke up with. And it says here with whom he lived. I do not remember now the source of this information. It comes from, you know, responsible, supposedly, as we call them, news sources. Well, more about this, I think it's more about this eyesight thing, because Dusseldorf prosecutors, this comes from Marseille, France, the byline, but they're the Dusseldorf prosecutors who are on this case, and what they are saying is that he had received psychotherapy with a note about suicidal tendencies for several years before becoming a pilot. So now they're coming out with his suicidal tendencies, and his problem was that he was depressed and to the point of being suicidal. It says here that spokesman Ralph Herrenbruch of the Dusseldorf prosecutor's office said, in the following period, and until recently, further doctor's visits took place, resulting in sick notes without any suicidal tendencies or aggression against others being recorded. That's what he said in a written statement. Prosecutors said they have so far found no indication of a motive that might have prompted Lubitz's actions, nor any sign of a physical illness. So they don't have any kind of proof that he had an eye condition. So they don't say he did. He may have worried about having an eye condition. At one point, they were calling it a detached retina. I think that was a mistake, an error. I wouldn't say that. It was just that he was worried about his eyes, and that would have prevent him from continuing as a pilot, and his whole concern was his career and being a pilot. So Christoph Kumpa, another spokesman for the Dusseldorf investigators, said there was no documentation showing that Lubitz had any physical ailment affecting his sight. So there you go. They don't have anything to prove that. They're not going to say it. They're not going to do it. So he went in for checks, but it appeared they didn't find anything, and he worried too much. They certainly can be in touch with that hospital. It says that he was there, and he was there twice, once for a follow-up, but they don't have they didn't find anything wrong with him, apparently. Now, the last leak, the last details about the doomed flight say that, that the captain, Patrick Sonderheimer, had said earlier in the flight that he hadn't had time to go to the bathroom before they took off. Although the flight was delayed, I don't think I have it here, but I read that today, that flight was delayed about 25 minutes. And so he was telling the, from the cockpit, he was talking to the passengers and saying that they might be able to make up that time because they had good conditions and so on. They might be able to make up that time and still land on the scheduled time. That happens fairly often. So at that point, at some point they were discussing the landing arrangements, which they discuss, well before landing, while they're in this flight pattern, high flight pattern, as it's called, the most safe part of the flight. They're high up there and just cruising along until they have to start coming down for landing, and so they're discussing the landing arrangements, and Lubitz is then suggested to the captain that he take a break since he was unable to go before leaving Barcelona, and he could go now. So then, on one thing, it says that that the captain says to him something like, take over now, something like that. You take over. And he just pushed, you could hear his chair being pushed back, and the door, you could hear the door closing. So that's when he left, and that's when, that was the, the terrible moment. Now, going to the medical problems of this guy and why nobody caught on to it, how he continued to fly with having all this long history of seeing psychiatrists and being given being told that he and being given medication, antidepressants, and so on, and being given notes, sick notes, so that the doctors would tell him you shouldn't fly now, you know, if he'd just been to see them maybe and they didn't think he was in too good a shape. Well, this Alistair Rosenshine, a former 747 pilot and now an aviation consultant, said reports of Lubitz's psychiatric problems were being, that his psychiatric problems being concealed were worrying. Somehow, he said, somehow the doctors he was seeing were either not aware he was a pilot or chose not to inform the airline or the regulatory authorities, he said. But if this, at least one doctor gave him notes, sick notes, to give to his employer, well, I suppose he could have given him sick notes whether he knew who his employer was or not. But if he did know that he was a pilot, then it would be more likely to give him these notes to excuse him from flying. And, of course, it wouldn't be good for his job, from Lubitz's standpoint, to be excused all the time for being sick. They wouldn't keep him on very long if that took place. So he never gave him these sick notes. And if he was decided not to take his antidepressants, don't really know about that. That's just purely speculation. But obviously he was not doing what he was supposed to be doing, and there was nobody who could, seemingly, who could do anything about it. Now, if he was living with a woman at this time, who was this woman and what was she saying? They don't really want to give out very much information. And I think it's all about the privacy thing. Everybody, I'm going to get into these privacy laws. This Rosenshine said that, to my mind, it would be amazing if that was the case. If the doctors either didn't know that he was a pilot or chose not to inform the airline, he said that would be amazing if they didn't inform the airline. Clearly, they would, in most circumstances, be culpable. Well, that's what I think. I think the most guilty party here, besides the parents, are the doctors who knew that he was a psychiatric type patient. And if they didn't inform the airline about this, that's, then some people say that it's the law tells you that you can't, but the doctors can get around that. So let's see. They found his body parts, but I don't think Lubitz's body parts, but I don't think that they will be able to tell anything about his mental, about his physical well-being or anything, his state from that. But so I want to skip down here just a little bit to take care of this. Okay, in Germany, after the war, that's me saying this. Okay, first I'll say Lufthansa has also made clear that Lubitz's medical records were subject to doctor-patient confidentiality and that the airline, therefore, had no knowledge of what they contained. Under German law, employers do not have access to employees' medical records, and sick notes excusing a person from work do not give information on their medical condition. Some politicians have called for a loosening of these rules in the wake of the German Wings disaster, I guess. But at a news conference in Berlin on Monday, a spokeswoman for the German Health Ministry said doctors already had the right to break their vow of confidentiality if they thought their patients posed a danger to others. Well, there you go. They have that right. Do they just not want to use it sometimes? In this case, did they not want to use it? Or did they not know how bad he was? It's possible that Lubitz was able to fool his doctors, too. That's what I think, because if he had learned how to behave and how to respond in ways that would cover up what he was really feeling, it's possible that you can do that. And he seemed to be pretty good at things like that. And therefore, he was. They thought that he was following their orders. They thought that he was using the sick notes, that he was doing what he was supposed to do. And he wasn't. So how would they know? I would think just on the face of it, if this man was had a condition like this and they knew that he was an airline pilot, maybe they didn't even know that. It just seems crazy to me. And I suppose all this stuff will be looked at. I just hope it all comes out. So this may be why no one reported him, if they didn't really realize that he was flying when they told him not to, if they did know he was a pilot. And they didn't go to the employer because they thought that he was following their orders. So, and you know, well, I'm going to go up here first and then come back to this and go through this little bit of business about Maria, the flight attendant that he said they eventually split up when she felt, well, she said they eventually split up when she felt unable to deal with his growing problems and his increasingly volatile temper anymore. Well, here's the thing. We've got this story about Maria, which sounds very convincing, and even saw a picture of her from the back. And then the Bild am Sonntag, I think they're too reliable, really, the Bild. But they do put out a lot of information, and fast, too. They don't hold it back. They reported that he had a girlfriend, now a teacher at a secondary school in a small town near Dusseldorf, who had recently told students she was expecting a baby. Huh. Where they got that? They didn't say any more about that, or I didn't see any more than that. That might be not worth much. But there is other reports that he's had a girlfriend presently, and that she very recently broke up with him. Now, this couldn't be Maria, because Maria said that they went together last year for about 5 months. She says, we dated for 5 months last year after meeting while working on a flight and would fly together around Europe, spending time in hotels together. So he was capable of doing all that. Maria told the German newspaper Bild, "We got to know each other last year on a flight and exchanged numbers. We met in hotels." Speaking of Lubitz's emotional makeup, she said it was difficult because of their jobs. I suppose there might be something that, or maybe it's difficult to find much time to spend together, maybe because of their jobs, because they're always on call to go on flights and so on. That might be what she means there. But she described him as a nice and open-minded person in public, but who needed constant love and reassurance in private. Well, there's a warning sign right there, that's for sure. If you have any experience with different partners at different times, you're bound to come across some of those. And she says he was a good man who could be very sweet. He brought me flowers. You see how they cover up? See how they made her think that he was always nice, and probably he brought her flowers maybe to make up for some of his scary times that she witnessed. And she said that he suffered from the pressure of his job, stating, "We spoke a lot about work, and then he became another person. he became agitated about the circumstances in which he had to work. Too little money, anxiety about his contract, and too much pressure. Well, this is very interesting. You know, he's clearly a person whose his problem is with his work, his problem is with his job, his problem is with feeling like the maybe Lufthansa has too high standards, and he feels he needs to keep up with everything and be, you know, excellent and get excellent marks and so on. And then he has to, it's too stressful for him. He doesn't handle it well. And so naturally, he blames it on Lufthansa. He blames it on that company. He blames it on that it's too much pressure and that he doesn't get enough money for all that he's going through and so on. But he doesn't want to lose a job either. So he's full of stress and confusions. Now this Maria, now here's the other thing. He locked her in the bathroom. Where is this at? I don't want to get lost here. At one time she said, gosh darn it, here it is. During conversations, she said, he'd suddenly throw a tantrum and scream at me. I was afraid. He even once locked me in the bathroom for a long time. Now, this is really scary. This is, you should leave somebody right away who does that. I think she didn't leave him right away after that, but she eventually did. And that shows a super controlling personality. But it's childish, too. Throwing tantrum stuff is childish, and doing things like that. It's terrible to be locked in a small space by someone who you can't trust to have your best interests in mind. Of course, if he locks you in, he already doesn't. But and to keep you in there for a long time, she said. Wow. You know, now, she is the one who should have reported him. She is very, very much at fault. They ought to prosecute her. Except that she's coming forth and telling this voluntarily on her own. I think she did. But she works for that airline, or she did. I don't know if she does now. But and she knows this deal. And she saw how sick he was. And she should have reported him to Lufthansa and told him about his problems. And maybe she didn't know that he was under a doctor's treatment. She might not have. And then she just thought he was one of these people who turned out to be someone she didn't want to continue in a relationship with. And then she was only thinking about protecting herself, which is natural. She would have been a young woman. He was only then 26, let's say. And she was maybe, what, 25 or something, 26 too or something. But anyway, that's young, in your 20s. That's young. And you're not—you don't feel like you're responsible for the world. You just feel like you're responsible for your own life. And she felt she needed to get away from him and hope that he didn't harass her. And if he stayed away, she didn't want to stir things up. That's just the way I would look at it. But she should have. She should have. I bet she realizes that now, and feels quite a bit of guilt over the whole thing. So let's see what I skipped. I don't want to miss anything. Okay, so the girlfriend and the father and the doctors all should have said something, all should have spoken up and said what they knew, intervened. But if the fathers could have been the most in the dark, as he didn't spend time with them, and he wouldn't. If this man was someone who could hide things, who could keep things from other people, that's what Maria said. Now we're done with that. Okay. Now my comments about this is that Germany, this is too much concern for the individual. This points to. Too much concern for the individual and not enough concern for the society as a whole and the the majority of people. So in spite of, contrary to what the New York Times was trying to say, Germany after the war became the opposite in every way to the Third Reich. They didn't, whatever the Third Reich was like, they, well, that was verboten, and this was thanks to the United States. And so individual rights became the supreme goal right away, and this is what the Jews promote in for European, white Europeans too, that we have to give every individual, we have to protect every individual's rights against the prejudice of the majority and so on. So this is being enforced, and not just enforced legally, but they're being brainwashed and indoctrinated into believing all of this. This is not the way it was in the Third Reich. The goal was to protect the community of folk and the national interest. And Hitler talks about that a lot in Table Talk. It comes up now and again, that very idea that is so important to National Socialism. It's not the individual. It's the, I don't want to use the word collective, but because it isn't that. It's really, it's the society and it's the community that counts. And if an individual is harmful to the whole society or the whole community, then he has to be done away with. He has to go. You don't allow him to continue to damage all these other people. Who are the innocent ones? He's not. I'm calling him a he, but in any event. So individual rights became the supreme goal, and protecting the individual is the object of the laws today in Germany. That's what it is. And in the guise of, you know, we realize protecting the individual is another way of saying protecting the Jew, but also protecting the not the alien, the immigrant, and so on. But that's a different issue, so really. Then Lufthansa has also made it clear that Lubitz's medical records were subject to this doctor-patient confidentiality, and that the airline therefore had no knowledge of what they contained. I've already gone through this, that this applied to this situation, even between an employer and their employee. The individual rights are supreme, and they have you can't look into their affairs. And the but as I already said, there is a doctors can do have a vow of confidentiality, and it is a law. It's German law, but they can break it if they think their patients pose a danger to others. Well, I suppose they're going to want exceptional proof of that, aren't they, before they do it. They probably don't want to do it because it's looked down upon. Maybe they won't get, the patients won't want to come to them once if it's learned that they've done that. Lots of things of that nature could apply there. And so nobody reported him because of all this cult of the individual, I've now called it, this focus on individual rights over community rights. Nobody reported him. The doctors felt that they have to care for him. He's their patient, not the community that he endangers. He's their patient, and he's the one they focus on. We see this all the time. We do see this on other situations. And the same thing exists in law enforcement. And even the airline couldn't feel that they could invade his privacy, that his employer, they had to accept his word on his own condition and behavior. Now, this is a real problem. If he said that he was okay, he had the okay from the doctors or whatever, if they had any awareness of that, then they had to believe him. They couldn't go to his doctor and say, well, is this guy telling us the truth? They couldn't do that. But the doctor could go to them. So this is the real problem, and I wonder if it's going to come up. You know, I wonder if it's going to be dealt with or talked about. I don't really think so. But I think that we should talk about it, and I would just encourage anybody listening to this who might agree with me to speak about it in this way and to try to push this idea where the problem really lies. It lies in the supremacy of the individual over the community, the community good. The individual good beats out the community good, which is the absolute wrong way around, and it's absolute opposite to what was going on in the Third Reich. And therefore, to say that all these things, you know, certain things happen because of the memory of the Third Reich, a bunch of hooey, that's just a big lie. I say here that nowadays German so-called leaders don't care about the nation. That's the truth. The community, or even German people. They don't. Certainly not ethnic German people. They are cared for the least, especially since hundreds of thousands of non-Germans have become citizens and are legally and socially seen as German, and you better not say otherwise in Germany. You better not. Now, as I say, this could be a wake-up call, but unfortunately, it probably won't be. And a footnote to this story, a man named Philip Baum, B-A-U-M, which is a German name, but he's in London as the he's based in London as editor of the trade magazine Aviation Security International, and he said, quote, "The knee-jerk reaction to the events of 9/11 with the ill-thought reinforced cockpit door has had catastrophic consequences." And I thought about that before I read this from him, and I thought, boy, that not being able to get into that cockpit was a big mistake. And what's so discouraging and disgusting is that it came from a lie. It's nothing even, you know, it wasn't even necessary. This 9/11 fakery is responsible in one way for the death of these passengers. These passengers too, along with the people who died on 9/11, and all the people who died since in the fight against so-called fake terrorism and so on. And now the death of these passengers on this German airliner, I think is as much as anything else is at fault and is to blame. Is this 9/11 crap that has happened? No, the laws and everything that have been passed. It's like us having the Homeland Security, which has been such a big pain in the behind, all for something that never really happened. And that, you see, that's Jewish. Whether Lubitz is Jewish or not, all that 9/11 stuff is Jewish, and that's a big lie like the Holocaust lie. So there's two Jewish lies there that are behind what happened on this airliner, allowing that sick person to be flying and having control of that airliner. And you know, another thing that came to my mind was that he was, I said that when he locked his girlfriend into the bathroom for a long time, that brought to mind him locking the door of the cockpit. The same kind of thinking, you know. Well, he knew he could do what he wanted he knew he could lock that captain out. And that's a mark of a controlling person. I bet he got a big happy feeling about that. He probably thought about it a lot, how he would lock him out, and then he would be in control of the whole plane. He'd be in control of all those people, and they would nobody could do anything about it because he knew about the strength of the cockpit door. And it wasn't going to be that much time, you know. It was only 8 minutes that the plane was going down far enough. So this is one thing about him that's clear, is that he's a super controlling monster, sick person, sicko. Okay, I'm going to play a little break music, just a short one, before I go into part two, which won't take too long. And what I'm going to play here is Where Did It Go? Oh, yeah, it's under M. I'm going to play this because it's kind of slow and not too lively, and the topic has been so horrible. I just find this crash to be just a horrible, horrible thing. I can't hardly imagine it, you know. It just puts me in a state. So I'm going to play Morganland by Peter Schreier because it's a quiet type song, and it lasts for 2 minutes and 49 seconds, 48 seconds. So we'll be back in under 3 minutes. Stay with me. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on March 30th, 2015, and we're now ready for part two. I want to say a few words about the Daily Stormer site and the new focus on being a man's place where women may be tolerated but not really invited. And I want to say how glad I am to hear that. That is a probably good solution for that site, and it is another victory for truth in a sense, because it is not a place where women are appreciated. So it might as well just kind of close it off. I have avoided commenting on Daily Stormer for as much as I can, although I did comment not so long ago a couple of times about this plane crash business and the pilot and his name, because sometimes I just can't resist. But I really don't read this site like I used to, and I only read comments when it's something that I really am interested in. I have been feeling very alienated from the mood of that, the tone of that site for several months, I'd say, increasingly. So I pretty much, I go there and about every day because I have certain places I look at every day just to see what's there. But I don't agree with it much, and there's not much there that I want to look at. So I'm not an avid reader or anything, and so it doesn't make any difference to me what happens there. Really, I'm not affected in the least by what's going on. I only find it kind of entertaining. It's sort of for entertainment and mostly to see what Andrew Anglin is saying there. That is, to me, so outrageous and often downright stupid, I have to say. So lately, he's been bashing women on Daily Stormer, and it's been going on for quite a while. And I've read some of these things that he has written, and I just shake my head, and I do sometimes feel like responding, but mostly I have not, and it's certainly smart if I don't. And now I have more reason than ever to never comment there again, which I certainly hope I will not do. I don't think I will. When you know that they don't care what you say, there's no point in saying anything. But the reason, it seems, is that the Daily Star, particularly Andrew Anglin, has been bashing women, is because he doesn't think that they subordinate themselves to white nationalist men as he thinks they should, and as the commenters on there would wish. And Andrew thinks he's such an important person that he should have the pick of attractive young white women who are just ready to be his helpmate. And today's spoiled women aren't willing to play the role that he wants them to, that he has assigned to them. And he assigned this role to women back when he came out with Total Fascism. But it didn't prevent him from being friends with women or being friends with me, because he mostly thinks these things about young women, younger women, the ones that they want and the ones that they want for wives and think should want to be their wives, but they don't. So they, you know, blame society and so on. But the thing is that he's been promoting this law of nature in the wrong way. You know, they use the law of nature as used in National Socialism to justify what they're saying and what they're doing. One thing I can tell you about Anglin is anybody can see who watches what he does. He's impulsive. And what race of people are known to be impulsive? Well, he's trying real hard to control his impulsiveness because he knows now that it gets him into trouble. But it's hard for him to do because at the moment he thinks he just wants to let go with it. And he also wants to go to the most extreme position. He likes to think of himself as extremely courageous and brave. And a lot of these people that follow him tell him that he is. And he feels he needs to do that to be the top kind of leader that he wants to be seen as. He does it so that he doesn't want to be following behind someone else. He wants to be out in front. So he goes to extreme positions, and that's the way he impresses, or that's the way he thinks he can impress everybody in the movement. Or in any case, that's just the way he is and the way he wants to do. Well, I just want to bring up some things. When I decided to talk about this on my program a little bit, I thought I'd better listen to that radio show he did with Sven Longshanks recently. I had quit listening to the radio, those radio programs they have on there. I haven't listened to one for a long time. So I downloaded this and started listening to it, and it wasn't very long, so that was good. But they bring up the Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden a couple of times as the perfect example of natural order. See, here's natural order. And however, I wonder if they think about how it is the woman who is supposedly in the natural order. They always say the woman naturally follows the man, and women don't have any mind of their own. They just have emotions, and they need to be controlled and so on. But their natural thing is to follow the man. That's all they know to do. And yet, why was it that Eve took the initiative to try something new by eating the apple in the Garden of Eden, while Adam then followed her example and followed her and did what she did. So they never bring this up in this story, but they like to use this story a lot to show how women have this evil streak and will go against God if you let them. And also, I'd like to point out that this story is a Jewish fable, although I realize Sven doesn't think so. But if you want to go by what Jesus said about women, well, he said a lot of positive things. But in one instance, he actually said that Mary, in the story of Mary and Martha, when he had come to the town and he was going to visit with these believers that were there, and they were at the house of Mary and Martha. And Mary was sitting there listening to Jesus speak, and Martha was in the kitchen doing, you know, preparing the food and so on for the men, for the hospitality. And Mary was supposed to be in there helping her, but she was out there listening to Jesus. And when she called out and told Mary, "Mary, what are you doing out there? There's a lot of work to be done here." And Jesus said, he actually rebuked Martha, and he told her that Mary had chosen the better part, that was listening to his words and learning while he was there, that the food in the kitchen could wait, but he was only there for a time, and Mary recognized that over the stereotyped role that she was supposed to play. And so I think that Andrew, as a Christian, fails to recognize that about his religion, which he doesn't know much about, and just doesn't know much about anything, really. But he never mentions this story, where he likes to mention the Garden of Eden, though. And then at one point, Anglin said, we've all had these horrible experiences with women. And I thought, wow. Right away I thought, well, I've certainly had my share of horrible experiences with men. And if I started in on it, it would be a very long show. But I still like men. I don't want to exclude men from, if I excluded men from my website, I wouldn't have hardly anybody looking at it, because it's mostly men. So I don't have anything against men, but, you know, women, and I know I'm not the only one, a lot of women have horrible experiences with men, too. So, and then Anglin said, I'm around a fair amount of Russians. You don't see them acting like that. They were talking about the Anglo men being weak and not being able to stand up to anything or fight, and I don't know exactly, but it was something like that. It was about the Anglo, putting down Anglo men, of which they are. They are Anglo men, but Anglin says, I'm around a fair amount of Russians. You don't see them acting like that. Greeks don't act like that. Well, there he is again. He loves the Russians, and he loves the Greeks. Maybe he is in Greece still. I don't know where he is. I don't know if he's gone to Russia. He hasn't, that I know of, he hasn't said so. But I don't read that much of what he writes anymore, so he could have said it. But he's got this thing about the Russians, and therefore the Slavs. He doesn't believe in all of them, but the Russians are the major Slavic group, so he's pro-Slavic, and he's always pro-Greek, just because of Golden Dawn, and because he spent time there. Okay, I'll just move on. He also said, in contrast, I am unapologetically arguing for a full-on return to medieval gender norms, quite literally. How dare you interrupt while men are speaking type stuff. Wow. And the men were just really eating, some of them that were really eating this up, but some of them criticized it, but he said, he says he wants to return to, he's not going to cause anything to happen. He doesn't have the power to do that, but he's expressing himself, so that's all right. He wants to return to the gender norms where women are not allowed to interrupt men when they're speaking. And if they do, they're going to be rebuked sharply. And when they get home, their husband might give them a couple of pops. So this is real male stuff, we're so important kind of stuff. And well, men should think they're important, but I think if they don't want to be interrupted by women, they shouldn't have the women around. They shouldn't be talking when the women are around, but they probably want the women to be serving them, or maybe their wife is around with children or something, or, you know, in situations that can come up where the women are doing the woman stuff that he thinks they should be doing. But if they should dare to speak up and when the men are having their conversation, and wow, that's not going to be allowed. He goes on to say, I'm quoting here from the radio show, there is some commonality between my position and the various positions of the men's rights movement, because the issues they bring up are symptoms of the core issue, which is that women should not have any rights at all. And this is the default position all throughout history, so there is no way to claim that this position is not traditional. Traditional is in quote marks. Well now, is he right about this? No, he's never right. He's hardly ever right about anything that he says. But this is not the default position throughout all history that women didn't have any rights. As a matter of fact, neither women or men had rights during all that time that they were, so many of them were serfs. And the only one that had rights was the big landowner whose land they worked on. And he could do anything. You know that situation where the nobleman of the area, who everybody was under his, governorship or something, even more than that, they had to get permission from him to do anything. And he had first rights to every virgin in his territory that he controlled. So every girl that came of age, he took her to bed first and took her virginity. And then she went off, and the other men could. The men of her own type got her after that, if they married her or whatever. This is really not right that these men were all powerful all the time and that women didn't have any rights, because women of the higher class and of the nobility and they did have rights. They were treated well, depending on where you lived, but he's just all wet there. Now, I'd say he realizes now he's been on the wrong track, see, because then he says to something that Sven said, he said, yes, there's no real personal motivation in let's stop these niggers, in quotes, when basically people can still avoid them and the economic consequences of immigration are so slow relative to a man's life. There has to be something more offered there. And that something needs to be an identity as part of a community. So Andrew is now searching to be a part of a community. He wants to create this community of males, and they all find an identity in their own male community there. Okay, so what he's been doing, he's saying, with showing what blacks and mestizos and Asians and so on do in Europe and in the USA, that's not where it's at, he thinks, now. It's not hurting people enough yet. So now he wants to do something to build up the male community. That's what he wants to do. It's not a bad idea. He says, this fact is always becoming more obvious to me, and I am definitely going to work hard to figure out how to make it more of a focal point of the site. I, of course, welcome any suggestions. Well, he won't take suggestions probably, but he wants people to think they can make them. However, it's going to be interesting to watch and see how he figures out how to make this identity, you know, identitarian community or something, which is not a new idea at all, which others have been talking about all along. And he's finally coming along and saying, well, I'm going to do this with my site. It just shows that He is impulsive, and he jumps from one thing to another, and he's still looking. You know, he's still searching for what can push something forward. At least he's trying to do that. I do give him credit for that. But, you know, he's still looking for his own identity. He's always been seeking an identity. That's why he went to the Philippines. He thought he could identify with something that he connected with that. But he found that he couldn't identify with Filipino people. So when he finally realized that, he left. Then he started reading some books and read Hitler, and then he took up National Socialism. But he called his site fascism because he thought, he says he did it because he thought that was easier for people to relate to than National Socialism, because that was, that included Hitler. So he started, he just came right out with that, what was it called? I can't even think of the name of it. But it was ultimate, like ultimate, total, that was it, total fascism. He tried to be real extreme and radical, and he promoted National Socialist things and lots of pictures and so on. And he got a lot of attention. I mean, he got an amazing amount of attention doing that. So then he wanted to compete with and do better than Alex Jones. He wanted to put Alex Jones out of business and have a white nationalist type Alex Jones site. So he did Daily Stormer, and it's been a huge success. I guess it has been. It gets a lot of, you know, we're told that it has all this traffic, and I don't doubt it, because it's the kind of thing that gets a lot of traffic. But how much it actually influences anything, you see, that's another thing. That's another question. And he's saying that he's not having the influence that he'd like to have. So now he's deciding these men on there are a bunch of trolls and jerks, really, who comment. A lot of them are. So now he wants to build up some kind of a male community. He thinks that's the way to go. Well, I give him, you know, I wish him well. I really wish them all well. But one of the consequences that has taken place, not because of this little switch here, but it has probably been going on over a period of time, is that from what was written about on yesterday on that site, I was happy to learn that this Marcus Cicero, this person who writes under the name Marcus Cicero, that's been there with Andrew for quite a while, probably a year or over a year, and doing a lot of really good posts. I just noticed some of the more recent ones lately, and I thought these are really good, and they're better than what he used to do. You know, he was okay, but so he came out and said that on this radio comment thread, revealed, I don't know, it's not that he revealed it, but he said that his ancestry was German. And he was also disagreeing with Andrew's stance on women. So I was very happy to see that, because I was happy to see that this Marcus Cicero is German, and that therefore I'm not surprised he can't stick with Andrew through thick and thin, because Andrew's positions are very un-German. And I think he used to kind of copy Andrew's style in his writing, or at least I thought he did. But he got over that, and he has his own style now, and his writing was very good. The other thing that I noticed was that he, back a year or so ago, maybe, he wrote some articles about Putin the Great, you know. He was admiring him too. But he stopped that. And lately, there was not much about Putin on the site, just once in a while, but it was always by Andrew now. And Andrew wrote a couple of them in the last week or two with his name on it, and then he had another one there today. Obviously, Marcus Cicero stopped writing about Putin, so Andrew had to pick it up if he wanted to have something about Putin on there. So I like to write to this Marcus Cicero, but I want to ask him if he's changed his mind about Putin, because that's the impression that I get that he has. So he's looking like a good, solid German, and what I find is that on Daily Stormer, in the comments, it is always German people who let you know that they're German in one way or another, who make the most intelligent comments, and who don't go all out for some of this stuff and even are slightly critical of it, or maybe real critical of it. But so it's the Germans who have the most balanced point of view, and Germans do not bash women, and Germans do not take that attitude that we're going to tell women that if they don't have any right to speak while we men are speaking, or something like that, you know. That's not the German way. Those National Socialists were very strong about the separation of the sexes but only up to a point, and they were very, very gracious to women, and they included women in most everything they could. Naturally, they didn't include women in the in their inner councils and so on. But if women were around, they didn't say, you serve the food and keep your mouth shut. They didn't treat women like that, so at all. So Marcus has found himself on the unable to agree with Andrew Anglin. You know, Andrew started this out not with so much the focus on men, but the focus on women and criticizing women in some of the most terrible ways. I think I've got a few comments here I can end up with. But I want to finish with Marcus here. I went through his archives at Daily Stormer to see when the last Putin article was that he wrote. And it was, or a Ukraine article. And the archives under his name only went back to January 2014. So I couldn't go back any further than that. There wasn't anything during that time. But he wrote a whole lot of stuff, but now he's gone from there. And I suppose he'll be showing up somewhere doing something. In fact, I'd like to have him on this program to interview him sometime. So I'll be trying to get hold of him. I don't know if he'll agree to do it. But I just want to say, hail Marcus. Hail Marcus Cicero. Well done. And my opinion of what's going on at Daily Stormer is the takeover of the losers among white men, but I do still wish them well. I really do. I always wish men well, and I know that they have a tough time. They are having a tough time. Let's see. There was something I wanted to say from this person, Hitler Truth. These are comments from this radio show I've been discussing. And somebody who calls himself Hitler Truth wrote, "Women don't tell you what they really want because they don't know what they want. Only an idiot or a woman would equate happiness with a new kitchen. A functioning kitchen is all you need. But if you think new tile or drapes will make you happy, you won't ever be happy, since materialism is always an empty pursuit." Well, how stupid. What you find so often with commenters who write things like this, especially, is that the name they give themselves is the opposite of what they really are and how they really feel. So this Hitler Truth is probably not a Hitler, pro-Hitler person at all. It's just someone who's trying to be just trying to stick it to women. He likes that part about it. And I want to tell him that it's silly to say that, because, of course, a new kitchen makes a woman happy, and a woman can be happy for a long time after she gets a new kitchen. And to say a functioning kitchen is all you need, no matter how dreary it is, but, well, you've got a sink there, and you got a stove of some kind, and you can put things in an ice box and so on. That functions. That's all you need. If you want more, well, you're never going to be happy because you're such a materialist. Wow, talk about going back to primitive times and being a dodo. Now, the fact is that Hitler gave Eva Braun everything she wanted. This guy wants to know about Hitler other than his time, because he couldn't give her his time, and he liked her and liked having her around. He didn't really want to lose her once he got used to her, and she was someone he could trust. She didn't go around blabbing things or acting in ways that were going to embarrass him. So he settled and was satisfied with her and was nice to her and liked her. She liked clothes. You know, she had a huge wardrobe, but he paid for that. He let her do that, and he didn't think that was a bad thing to do, because it was like a compensation for her, and it made her somewhat happy for a while. Anyway, let's see here. Oh, this one I have to mention. This is Andrew Anglin writing a comment, March 28th. "Domestic violence being perpetrated by white men is largely a feminist hoax, which is why the Jews are all up in it. I'm not saying that it never happens, ever, but you watch the Jew TV, and it is like some regular occurrence that white men just get drunk and beat their wives for no reason." Is that true? I don't watch TV, but I don't think that TV shows white men beating their wives all the time because they got drunk. I don't think that that's what the TV is showing. If, you know, there might be a couple of programs that have that, but not all the time. And domestic violence is not a feminist hoax. A lot of feminists do try to take advantage, try to make a lot out of it and talk about it and so on. I agree with that. They do, but there still is domestic violence. And men do, white men do get drunk and beat their wives for no reason, but because they're drunk. And it does happen. And not, I'm not saying the majority do that or even a big minority, but it happens. So it's silly to downplay it because it's a serious and it's a real problem. It can be a real problem. And there, women are not making it up. There's some women might have exaggerated it or something. You have to know the women. But you, it used to be that this happened and it was real. And it wasn't right either. And to say women don't have any rights, then this can happen. One of the biggest problems with women not having any rights is that they are abused by the men in their lives. Oh, here's the one. I have to say this. Andrew wrote on March 29th in a comment to this radio program thread, "It's just basic biology, really. If men were to take injections of estrogen on a daily basis, they would eventually become incapable of distinguishing reality from their personal emotions." So he has said this so many times that, which I really objected to, and every time I've objected to it, I mean, in my own mind, when I read it, I think, why? What is, you know, that is so anti-female here, you know, because he thinks that women, he's saying that women cannot distinguish reality from their emotions. And he said this many times in many ways, that all women are unable to distinguish reality from personal emotions. All they see is what their emotions tell them. They cannot see apart from that. They're so emotional. And that comes from them having a lot of estrogen in their bodies. Well, the other thing he says is women are like children. He says that women are no different than children. Men have to take care of women. They have to look after them and care for them because they can't care for themselves. And something else he said, which is clearly meant only for children. Children behave this way. Children are completely incapable of being on their own. I think that's what it was, something like that, that you can't leave children on their own, children or women. You know, you have to look after them in the same way. So he equates women with children, and they're not any more. And oh yeah, I know. He said you don't give rights to children. Oh, that, I probably skipped that up there somewhere. But you don't give rights to children any more than you, why then you should you give rights to women? You know that there's no difference between a woman and a child. That's pretty shocking. And a lot of the men are rejecting what he's doing and saying, but he doesn't care because this is how he wants to express himself, and he's determined to continue on this track. And so I say all power to him and good luck. And it's interesting, but it's not new because this kind of thing has come up before. And it doesn't get anywhere, and it's never going to get anywhere. What he is recommending there is never, ever going to take place in this world. And he doesn't have the power to cause it to. So, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to say good night now, and thank you for listening to this rather chatty program. This is Carolyn Yeager. I'm saying good night for the Heretics Hour on March 30th, 2015. And I might see you next week. Anyway, continue to watch my website, carolynyeager.net, for future events. Good night.